Blog Talk Radio.
Hello and welcome to Book Buzz. I'm Susanna Greenberg, your host, and today we will be speaking with novelist M.J. Moore. Hello, M.J., how are you today?
Doing really well, thank you.
Ah, glad to hear it, and thanks for being here. M.J.'s first novel, M.J. Moore, is called For Paris with Love and Squalor. Will be out this spring, May. Let me tell you, J.G. Salinger's The Catcher in the Rye, of course, is one of America's most translated, taught, reprinted, and beloved books, having sold some 65 million copies. For Paris with Love and Squalor, a debut novel by M.J. Moore, our guest today, is a passionate tribute to Salinger's legacy. It's narrated by a dying 92-year-old paraplegic in 2015 who lovingly remembers a soldier named Jerry. This novel concocts Salinger's years as a Second World War GI and the life of one woman who adored him. Our guest today, M.J. Moore, is a biographer and book reviewer. His writing has appeared in the Paris Review, the Daily New World Review, the International New York Times, and Literary Hub. Kenneth Flewenski, author J.D. Salinger, A Life, has said of this book, "In For Paris with Love and Squalor, we share not only the narrator's memories, but also her passion for literature, for music, and for film, plus her insightful zest for life that leads to a love affair with one of the great authors of the 20th century, a smart and poignant journey through a life well-lived, at once lighthearted and bittersweet." What a wonderful world of praise and well-deserved. And MJ, let me ask you a few questions about your novel, For Paris with Love and Squalor. That title clearly echoes J.D. Salinger's most famous short story, For Esme with Love and Squalor. You know, why so? What's the connection? Does Salinger figure in this novel? And why Paris? And is this novel a love letter to the City of Light? Tell us about that.
Oh, it's most definitely a love letter to Paris. And Paris is the ultimate motif of ecstasy, joy, and human exhilaration, because this narrator was a WAC. She was a member of the Women's Army Corps, the WACs, and she was in service with the WACs between 1943 and 1945, and it was her unique fate not only to have two life-transforming encounters with a young GI whose name was Jerry Salinger. Indeed it was. He was in the 4th Infantry Division, and after being in training and whatnot in America, went overseas and was part of the D-Day landings and much, much more, including the liberation of Paris. And in this novel, our narrator, who is talking out her tale from a hospice suite in the year 2015, is finally unburdening herself of a story she has kept secret for all the decades of her post-war life. And the highlight of that story is not just her impromptu meeting with G.I. Salinger at Radio City Music Hall in 1943, where they witnessed one of the final stateside performances of Glenn Miller's Army Air Force Band, but they had a spontaneous, serendipitous, extraordinary second encounter in this novel in Paris at the very end of August 1944, when an entire week was devoted to the celebrations of liberation, and a few days after the famous parade with Charles de Gaulle And so many, 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 many thousands gone, there was another parade involving the 28th Infantry Division of the U.S. Army. And as eyewitnesses to that, G.I. Salinger and this nameless narrator experience some rather soul-stirring and heart-rending and then heartbreaking revelations about what the war has done, what the war has done.
Let's talk
to
about that. Let me interrupt you and move on to the next question. You've mentioned the narrator. Let's talk about that narrator a bit more. In your book, For Paris with Love and Squalor, you have a nameless female narrator in 2015 telling the story from a unique vantage point that she flashes back effortlessly to 1944 and other past times. And to put it bluntly, she is literally talking out story by speaking into cassette tapes provided in hospice by a treasured caregiver. How does her spoken prose affect the novel's texture, and why is she a nameless narrator?
The nameless narrator decision resulted from a desire to have this narrative work on two levels. On the one hand, knowing what we know about Salinger's craving for privacy and for not having boundaries crossed, mm-hmm. we have to assume that our narrator certainly was well aware of this Salinger legacy. It's how he has been defined ever since the very early 1960s in particular, when he had long since retreated up to Cornish, New Hampshire, and the hermit reputation was being cultivated, the recluse. Well, by remaining nameless as she talks out this story of their encounters many decades ago, she is ensuring that she cannot be tracked down, so to speak, or identified, and thus she's helping to guarantee or enhance or at least respect Salinger's legendary craving for being left alone. On a simpler level, like so many individuals, so many folks, especially who seniors, who may start journaling or may start accepting interview requests with their great-grandchildren or someone else at the very end of a long, long life, there is a tendency toward modesty and restraint. And here, all she really wants to do is get to the story and not necessarily focus on my name is and I, and all of the other perpetual self-referential madness of, the age of texting. So on a number of different levels, keeping the narrator nameless was a decision that, in a way, the book decided it for me. I began this book thinking, I'm going to write a novel and try to recapitulate the experiences of a G.I. Joe who encountered Salinger during the war. And the next thing I knew, a female narrator had taken over and was in charge. And it surprised me more than anyone. And so...
But who's in charge of the writing? The characters or the author?
The character. The character of the nameless narrator, she just took control of this narrative, and it just astounded me that suddenly this novel informed me that it had to be written in the voice of an aging female nameless narrator And then it occurred to me, it might be really nice for all readers, any reader whatsoever, to be able to call her whatever they will, envision her as they see fit, and just, again, reinforce Salinger's penchant for privacy by not having her identified in a way that, if this were a true life CSI story, you know, she could be tracked down or outed,
okay,
something like that.
Let's talk a little bit more about our first person nameless narrator in your book, For Paris with Love and Squalor. She's a woman who has loved books, film, and music all of her life. Aside from all the historical elements regarding the liberation of Paris in August 1944 and how she was a WAC, along with a GI named Salinger, witnessed that ecstatic event, how does music in particular enhance this tale? Her memories of the swing era are meticulous. Why so?
I would like to think that readers will feel, while perusing this narrative, that they are not just reading words or seeing a text, but that they are hearing and feeling the rhythms and cadences of a musical work. Shifting tempos, alterations of tone. The narrative, I really hope, does convey the unique sensibility of someone who has just been passionate about music ever since adolescence, which in her case, the narrator of this particular novel, on page one, identifies herself as a swing kid. She was chronologically born in 1922, and as such was 16 in 1938. She was right on time for the swing era as it evolved and developed and had its first peaks in the 1930s, especially the second half of the 1930s, with the rise of Benny Goodman and the majestic achievements of Duke Ellington and so many others. And it carried over right into the 1940s, giving the Second World War its soundtrack, so to speak.
Okay.
And
we're getting towards the end.
Music is the life.
Yes.
Go ahead, please.
I just want to reiterate, again, we're speaking with author M.J. Moore about his book For Paris with Love and Squalor, a novel coming out this May 2017. And let me ask you one more question about the book before we close, which is, you know, the novel's musical motifs and all of its joyous recapitulations. The mythic liberation of Paris at the end of August are countered by a discernible grief that permeates the story. How does grief function as a leitmotif in For Paris with Love and Squalor? Is it a cathartic? And then we'll probably have to close with this question, so I thank you in advance. So let's speak a little bit about grief and how it functions in For Paris with Love and Squalor before we go.
Well, this particular narrator is the only child of a veteran of World War I who, without having PTSD as a definition back in the day, very much manifested all the symptoms of what we would now call post-traumatic stress disorder. And in contrast to the joyous swing music that often infiltrates this narrative, or her preoccupation with how dancing and the sensuality of dancing to the great big bands was a true coming-of-age rite of passage for the swing kids of the World War II generation. She also gives voice to her lifelong awareness that her World War I veteran father was badly affected by PTSD And she feels that the entire society of these United States has been much the same in the aftermath of the Second World War, Korea, and Vietnam, etc.
Okay, I think that ends our episode, Michael. I'm not sure we caught the last few words. I hope we did. If we're still recording, I just want to say thank you very much. And that concludes our interview. Thanks. Bye-bye.
Thank you so much. Bye now.